Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food.
And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Well, normally on Sourcing Matters, we talk about food and agricultural and production. Today, we're going to talk a little about something different. We're going to talk about wine. And wine is more than just any libation. It's an experience steeped in history. These aged grapes, or grape juice, connects us with place and time. It's part of our rituals and beliefs. It's tied to us, our friends, and our family. And we've got from the highest end vintages that are matured and aged for decades to the low-end box of wine that we have at the corner stores that you can get for a couple bucks. That cold-fired fermenting offers a full spectrum of offerings that now account for a $62 billion domestic industry. The success of the industry is tied to its ability to differentiate these offerings and the region it's from and the elevated production approach that's used with it. The age process, the unparalleled cuisine connection, and through developing an ecosystem of aficionados that have become increasingly interested in each and all of those unique factors that further connect the consumer with the drink of their choice and all its affinities. Our focus on Sourcing Matters has been food and ag, but wine is the category I most often point to as aspirational standards for the future of food systems. Now, what I found interesting in doing some research and having our guest on today is the earliest known winery actually dates back 6,000 years. And it's believed that it was done even thousands of years before that, not necessarily in a traditional winery approach, but maybe in the home spirit producer. And stateside, our lineage really, which is tied to California, which represents 66% of all wines sold in the U.S. as of 2017, and just to give some context to that, all other U.S. states combined represent 8%, and the remaining factor is from imports. Well, we didn't get production agriculture on Vitis in our country on the West Coast until the West Coast Gold Rush, in fact. And as many focus on extractive mining and destroying the soils to pull metal out of the ground, it was actually the smart and pragmatic folks who realized they could invest in the land as a regenerative natural resource, one that would provide perpetual returns for centuries after all the gold is gone. And so California wines have earned actually street cred in the last 40 years. 1976 Paris Wine Tasting, there was a panel of all renowned French judges that gave Cali wines a nod in each and every category. So somehow in this spot in France, in Paris, in 1976, locale for California trumped local for French and Paris wine, Parisian wine, in all categories. They called it actually the judgment of Paris. And this changed the industry and set course for a new path of U.S. wines. So since, the industry has continued to evolve, and it's really the smart folks that were the ones who connected the old world with the new one. So on today's show, we're lucky to have a partner and a family member of one of these thought-leading California wine families who capitalized and advanced this modern gold rush of California resources. They are truly shepherds and not miners of our prime natural resources, and I'm excited to learn more for what we're going to talk to today. So today we welcome Jason Haas, who's a partner and a general manager at Tablas Creek Winery. Hey, Jason, how you doing?
Doing great. How are you, Aaron?
Yeah, well, and I feel like I always apologize to our guests that I always lead with a long intro, but I just wanted to connect some points for our listeners who I obviously ramble on quite a bit about food and production agriculture, animal agriculture. So it's nice to take a step back and look at another category that's doing it very well. So you are producing Chateau Noir de Pape. I think I said that wrong. I apologize. My French since high school has gone downhill. But it's a Rhone wine. Is that correct? And it's native to southern corner of France. And it's coming from your family-owned California winery, which is situated basically squarely between San Francisco and Los Angeles. I read that it was your father, Robert, who formulated this unique partnership with an acclaimed French family, the Perrins, and launched your winery, the Tablas Creek Winery, in 1989 with the first vintage in 1997. And I saw that you Jason, were the son of Robert, and that you've been the general manager there for 12 years, and you were awarded by your peers the 2015 Paso Robles Wine Country Wine Industry Person of the Year and the 2017 San Luis Obispo Country Wine Industry Person of the Year. So great, great awards for you who's taking over the reins and working and progressing the industry. So
thanks.
Yeah, of course. So Jason, I'm just going to give you a little precursor here and say, I am no expert in wine and nor do I pretend to be, nor the production of Vitis. So I have a great deal to learn, but I'm surely excited to have you on to get me up to speed. And I'm sure our listeners will be saying the same thing. So let me jump in with the questions and say, could you tell us a bit more about Tablas Creek and your focus as a modern winery in California?
Sure. And modern is an interesting term. I think in a lot of ways, the pursuit of great wine is sort of a pushback against a lot of what we think of as modern in agriculture. And one of the things I thought was really interesting about your lead-in is that I feel like people are getting more and more interested in sourcing and basically the place and the production by which the food that they eat or that they prepare comes to them. And I feel like that's something that wine has a real head start on a lot of the rest of agriculture in, because wine is a product which is so tied to place and has been celebrated as coming from a specific place for centuries now, whereas you're only recently seeing the same thing with a lot of other foods. So, for us, a little bit of background on Tablas Creek. We are, as you mentioned, a Rhone we use a Rhone model for our winery. We're a partnership between my family and a family of winemakers from the Rhone Valley in the south of France. Their region over there is Châteauneuf-du-Pape. So we don't make Châteauneuf-du-Pape here. We can't make it here. It can only be made in that, what's called an appellation. It's essentially a delimited area around the village of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, which is close to Avignon in the Rhone Valley in the south of France. But we have tried to translate their model into California. And the way that this all got started is that my dad was a wine importer. He represented wineries from around France and around the world, and would go on trips around the U.S. with French producers, kind of introducing not just the producer, but the producer's region to an American wine-consuming public that was still sort of in its infancy in the 60s and 70s when he was doing this. And California was an important part of these trips because there's a big population and it's a huge wine market. And every time he would come to the Bay Area with the two brothers who run the estate called Chateau de Beaucastel from Châteauneuf-du-Pape, they would leave talking about how much California reminded them of the south of France, how it really felt like a Mediterranean climate, and how surprised they were that in this Mediterranean climate, they didn't see anybody focusing on the grapes that they were used to using from the Mediterranean part of France. So when you think of wine production in California, most people will probably think of grapes like Cabernet and Chardonnay and Merlot and Pinot Noir. And those have traditions in France. Cabernet and Merlot are originally from Bordeaux. Pinot Noir and Chardonnay are originally from Burgundy. And those are more continental parts of France. The grapes from the south of France are grapes like Syrah and Grenache and Mourvèdre and Roussanne and Marsanne and Viognier. And those are the grapes that we chose to focus on with Tablas Creek. So we spent... I was in high school at this point, so this was not me doing the search, but my dad and the parents spent 4 years looking in the late 80s to try to find a spot that would end up being the best possible fit in terms of soils and climate and rainfall, and ended up in 1989 buying 120 acres in the hills west of the town of Paso Robles, which, as you mentioned, is kind of dead center between L.A. and San Francisco. It's a couple hours north of Santa Barbara and a couple hours south of Monterey. And it's removed from the Pacific by one range of mountains. So we're only about 11 miles from the ocean where we are here, but we're the direct impact of the ocean is blocked by the Santa Lucia mountain range. So that allows it to warm up here during the day, and then it cools down dramatically at night because we're at 1,500 feet elevation, and there's this huge reservoir of cold air that sits about 11 miles away over the Pacific. We then decided to bring in cuttings of all of the principal grapes from the Perrins estate in Chateauneuf-du-Pape, which included new high-quality cuttings of some grapes that were already in California, like Grenache and Mourvèdre. But it also included some grapes that had never been used here before, which we brought in, and like Grenache Blanc and Counoises and Roussanne and Picpoul, which we brought in, built a grapevine nursery, planted in our own vineyard, and then made available to the larger community to help get the category that we wanted to thrive off the ground. So, as you mentioned, it did take a while. We started in 89. We bought the property. We had to wait 3 years for the vines to clear a quarantine process. We got them out of quarantine in 92. Took 2 more years of reproducing vines before we had enough to start planting. And then got vines on the ground in 94. It takes 3 years to get your first crop. And that gets us to 97 when we had our first vintage. So the production methods that we use, we started with the model that they use at Beaucastel, which meant organic farming. They've been farming organically since the 1960s. And then trying to get the grapes through the fermentation process with a minimum of our fingerprints on them. So you think of kind of modern industrial winemaking, you end up, you pick the grapes, but then you're correcting their chemistry. You're adding acid, you're adding nutrients, you're adding yeast to get them to ferment in a specific way. And then you're probably putting them into new oak, or maybe you're using extracts of oak flavor to get the things that you want. And we instead are using entirely native yeasts. We feel like that's a part of our own signature of place. We ferment everything separately, and then rather than correcting the chemistry on any individual grape, we'll blend different grapes together. So if there's something which is low in acid, great, we have other things that are higher in acid, and we will use one to highlight the things we like about another and to shore up its weaknesses. So in a lot of ways, it's a very old-fashioned way of making wine, not radically different other than that we have some nice things like refrigeration, but not radically different than what you would have seen a century or two ago.
So, Jason, let me ask if I could, because I think it's a key element to jump in on is on the production side. And I think one of the areas that you have focused on from our previous discussion and doing some reading is how to differentiate by biodynamics. And taking a look at the site, I saw that after you got your ducks in a row and you brought your Vitis and your vines over from into the U.S. and with the 3-year process, and then you set up your approach for oak aging in large barrels, you've seemed to turn to natural order to further enhance your offerings. So could you share with our audience a bit more of, we do have some familiarity with what biodynamics and what it would be, but maybe if you could share a bit of what that means within the wine industry and how that has evolved your offerings.
Sure. So as I mentioned, we started off with organics as our baseline. And we did that because we felt like we really wanted to allow the wines or the grapes to show the character of the place that we were in, and hopefully that would translate into the wines. And felt like the less that we put on from the outside, the greater the chance that we'd be able to show off our own signature of place. And biodynamics was really the next logical step in that. And the reason, if people are trying to wrap their heads around the differences between organics and biodynamics, like organics is essentially best thought of as a list of things you can't do. So basically means no chemical fertilizers or herbicides or pesticides. And basically, if it's not on the list of things you can't use, then great, you can use it. So biodynamics is it takes the same ideal, but kind of switches it around so that instead of trying to come up with non-chemical alternatives to provide fertilization or pest control or weed control from the outside, you're trying to create a self-sustaining ecosystem that largely makes that unnecessary. So you try to foster biodiversity in your vineyard so that you have natural predators for whatever the pests might be that are a nuisance. You try to build soils that are vibrantly healthy so that you have a wide range of microorganisms in the soils. You try to incorporate animals into a farm. So we have a flock of about 200 sheep and alpacas, a couple of donkeys and a llama that we pasture in the vineyard in the winter, so they eat the cover crops, they fertilize with their manure, mix it in with their hooves. It means we don't need to bring in fertilizer from the outside. It means we don't need to mow, or at least we don't need to mow as much, don't need to run tractors through and compact the soils. And it's essentially simulating the natural balance you would find in a diverse ecosystem. I mean, the thing about most farm units is that they're monocultures, and those are naturally kind of brittle systems, because what you have is a whole bunch of one item, and that's a very attractive destination for something that might choose to prey on that particular thing, and there probably are not natural controls in place that would eat the thing that would eat your crop. And so biodynamics, you're trying to reestablish as much of that natural diversity as you can. And for wine, it has the added appeal that it does tend to emphasize the signature of your place, which is kind of the holy grail for most winemakers. The French call the concept terroir, which I think is kind of best thought of as signature of place. Or my dad used to call it somewhereness, which I like the tone of.
It's a good description. I think looking at it from a systems approach versus the reductionist approach is a proper definition of that. It gives people the ability to materialize the difference. It's ideology, yes, but it's completely shifts the approach that you would take in your production model, always looking to connect to natural order versus trying to control it. And I think that we have seen it materialize a bit in food, not nearly what we've seen in wine, and in fact that leads to the next category, the somewhereness or the terroir idea, which I look at wine as being leading the way for many other categories of food and beverage, like beer and tea and coffee, yogurt, sweets, savories, and even things like merroir, which is the place of the ocean for oysters, which if you come to the Northeast, you can get a menu that offers oysters 5 miles up and down, 5 miles from one another up and down the Eastern Seaboard that will have a completely different oyster offering. So why has wine, or how has wine been able to establish such a food category differentiation through diverse palates? And for us who are fighting this for better food and in the center plates and the salad plate, why has wine been so successful engaging consumers in those many values and the offerings? And what can we take out of that? How can we do things better within the food systems?
Man, that's a big question.
You got plenty of time, Jason. Take the time you need. No problem.
So I can answer the first part of the question. I'm not sure if I can answer the second part of the question.
Okay.
I'll give it a shot. I feel like wine has had a leg up in a lot of this for a couple of reasons. One, there are so many different wine grapes that have come to be connected to certain places that you have the signature of that place, which is kind of tied into also the signature of that grape. So if you think of what makes Burgundy different from Bordeaux, from Rioja, from Chateau Neuf du Pape, from Tuscany, from Alsace, in terms of wine. You have different traditions of different grape varieties that have evolved over the course of thousands of years in a specific area. And grapes are, and there are thousands of different varieties of vinifera grapes, so wine-making grapes. And a lot of them evolved by chance in relative isolation from one another. And there are a high percentage of these different grape varieties that are grown in a single village in Italy or Greece and nowhere else. And of those, there are maybe a few hundred that have succeeded enough to kind of transcend their original location and be planted in multiple places around a country or around the world. And of those, there's maybe a dozen or so that are kind of internationally known. So you have, with wine, you have this combination of diversity of genetics and then the signature of the genetics tying into the character of wines from a specific place. And you have a product that is enough of a value-added product that you don't necessarily have grapes a commodity the way that you might with something for which there is less reward for making something really distinctive and unique. I mean, I think you do have a similar sort of thing in the world of cheese. But why this hasn't happened to the same extent with other food products or vegetables, I'm not sure. I do think there is something. There is the long tradition of the connection to place that the French have fostered, particularly through the starting in the early 20th century, and then you have the fact that people around the world see the value in differentiating Pomerol from Bordeaux, and therefore you draw a finer line around an area. You try to figure out what makes that smaller area really unique and valuable, and then do your best to come up with those areas that are worthy of delineation and recognition. But I think that it does, one thing that wine does is I think it provides a language for people to talk about the place origin and the signature of place of foodstuffs. I mean, I love your example of Merloir, because that is, of course, a play off of terroir, and it's riffing on the familiarity that people have with the kind of the given that wine can have a signature of place. And I think you will see more of it. I think you already have seen more of it as people try to rediscover heirloom breeds of different vegetables and livestock, and as those different breeds are celebrated for what they are, and not just a more productive, easier to pack and ship version of a particular foodstuff. But how any given product might go from where it is to something closer to what wine grapes have been able to do, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah. It is, and I'll just say more of from the outside looking in, and what it seems that sort of the California wineries have done very well, the elevated standard production models associated to that, is as you said, you defined a common vernacular, language that can be spoken, shared within the industry. You're always educating people the value of this. It seems you've done a wonderful job of developing those aficionados, those people that engage in your program. And you know, it seems you engage folks from agrotourism to knowledge share to making this a general experience. And it's so interesting because we look at the U.S. and I think it's amplified in the domestic U.S. market, where you get those same consumers who would be engaged in buying a couple $100 bottle of wine, but then they have no correlation of why there's associated values to what's in that center plate. What is the protein on the plate? Where's the salad greens coming from? But you know, I guess we develop affinities and association to those values. So it's again, from my perspective, I'd love to just dig a little deeper into that $62 billion domestic U.S. Wine industry, and ask you a couple questions in there, and seeing why those consumers are engaging in these elevated standards or these differentiated production offerings. So I read in doing research on the industry is that about 40% of adult Americans regularly drink wine. And if you look at the demographics of that, it's definitely the baby boomers that have the highest percentage of wine consumption. But what was surprising to me, and maybe it's not surprising, maybe it's that correlation to food, is that category is followed very closely by millennials, the 21 to late 30s, that are actually the second largest volume of consumers drinking wine. So in your offerings at Tablas Creek and in even the California industry as a whole, how do you appeal to those diverse audiences? How do you find and offer a broad stable of product offerings, or do you focus on attributes that might strike the fancy of those consumer base? What crosses over? What correlates to get those two big buckets of future consumers to look at your wine and the story and the place and the terroir, why it all matters?
So I think different wineries obviously would have different answers to this. There are certainly large wine companies who do try to have a wide range of offerings that might appeal to very specific niches. I don't think that that's practical or advisable for a smaller winery like us. I think wine is kind of the ideal product for long-tail marketing in that, I mean, we make about 30,000 cases of wine a year. So that's whatever, 360,000 bottles. We don't need millions of fans. We're not something that's looking for mass consumption. If we can get 20, 30,000 fans who really love what we're doing, that's plenty. And so I think it's more valuable for most wineries, certainly most smaller wineries, to be consistent and somewhat more focused in what they do, and then do their best to make sure that they get out in front of people so that you help the people who are going to tend to like the things that you make find you. So we do a lot of work. We spend a lot of time out pouring wine at wine festivals or doing work with other wineries who share either our region or the style of wine that we make. It's not there's a lot of cooperative marketing in the world of wine because wine's not a zero-sum consumer good. So somebody who buys a bottle of someone else's Rhone blend is not less likely to buy a bottle of Tablas Creek. They're more likely to buy a bottle of Tablas Creek. So marketing ourselves along with other people who make similar style wines as we do, or marketing us along with other wineries from our region, makes a lot of sense. So I think that's been our answer to this, has been try to introduce ourselves to a pretty wide range of people who might be interested. We do, even though like 80% of our revenue comes from the wine that we sell direct, so either out of our tasting room or out to one of our wine clubs. We have maintained a pretty robust presence in restaurants around the country because we feel like that's a place where people are going to discover new things that they might then want to know more about. So we think of that piece of what we do is largely an investment in outreach. And then try to make sure that once once someone does walk through our front door of our tasting room, that we give them a really memorable experience. We try to bring them inside the process that we use to make the wines. We focus on education. We try to demystify as much as we can why we do the things the way that we do them, and try to create a few lifelong fans each day, and figure that then those people will become advocates for us, and it will kind of grow outwards from there.
Yeah, I like the idea of rising tides, right? So when you all work together and work as a non-zero sum and a cooperative, and you're not predatory in the approach of retaining one customer versus gaining the folks that are going to care about that, it seems that you can differentiate by region, by that locale, by that somewhereness, which I do like that comment quite a bit. So let me take that next. You had mentioned your tasting room, or one of the things that I was intrigued by is wine's ability to engage in agritourism. In fact, I think it's again another benchmark, another baseline that we can use in food systems. That we've seen it definitely in beer. We've seen it in other production agriculture, small multidimensional farms that are getting this. But again, they're only taking pages out of the book of what we've seen in major wine regions, where people specifically travel to those regions to engage in those experiences. So as you talked about that retention of those kind of super fans, and then engaged consumer base. So what do you do at Tablas Creek for those, or what else have you seen done that you'd like for aspirational for that agritourism model, where you would have that deeper connection to empower your consumers for gaining deeper affinity for your offering? And it doesn't have to be the 20 or 30,000 people. It could be maybe a few hundred, a few thousand per year that you really are trying to engage in your experience.
So you mentioned one of the key pieces, which is, I think, work as a community. We do in Paso Robles, we do three big wine festivals every year. We do a Zinfandel festival in March. We do the Paso Robles Wine Festival in May, and then we have the Paso Robles Harvest Festival in October. And we know that each of those are going to bring 10,000 to 15,000 people into the area. And pretty consistently, according to the surveys that we've done, half of those people are new at each event. It's their first time visiting Paso Robles, or at least first time visiting Paso Robles for the wine that's here. And so when they say you never get a second chance to make a first impression, I mean, you do your best in those sorts of opportunities to really help people fall in love. Make sure that you participate in them. Make sure that you're not just using them as a free traffic boost for the weekend, but instead you're adding something to the appeal of the event as a whole. Doing whether that's an educational thing, whether that's getting people behind the scenes and showing them how it works, whether it's music, whether it's food, whether it's tying it in with a celebrity. I mean, there's all sorts of different ways that you can add value to the events that you participate in. So I think that's an important piece of it. I have this interesting dual perspective in that in France, this still hasn't really happened. France, which is the kind of home of wine tourism isn't really something that the French do or understand. So if you go and make an appointment to visit a winery in France, they will assume that you're a member of the trade, because the idea that the end customer might be interested in visiting a winery is pretty foreign to them, any more than, like, why would you want to go and see the factory where your shoes are made? Like, the idea that you would do this in wine is a new one for the French. So we had to figure it out for ourselves in California. Our initial idea was that we were not going to have a tasting room. We were just going to make the wine here, and we were going to call up our distributors every year and tell them the new vintage was ready and they were going to buy the wine, and our next contact with the market would be a year later when we would call up the distributors and say the next vintage was ready. And we realized, it felt like fairly quickly, but I'm sure it was much more slowly than it should have been, that this was not a very efficient or effective way to market a new winery. Is that people really wanted to have a memory that they associated with it. They wanted to be able to think of the place that they had this wine and associate it with, associate the wine that they were having with the place and with the people who made it or the people who they visited with. And so we had to open, it took us 5 years from when we built our building and theoretically had our opened our doors to actually have a tasting room that people could come and visit. That didn't happen until 2002. And looking back on it now, given that that's really the lifeblood of our business, it seems crazy that it took us so long to figure this out. But it did. So I don't know if I totally answered your question, but I think that giving people experiences that are memorable, that they can associate with your place and your product, is the name of the game. The fact that people do look at going out and going wine tasting as an appealing thing to do, kind of a romantic thing to do, is a really cool thing. It's not something that I take at all for granted, because it's not true necessarily elsewhere around the world. And I think we have a lot to, all of us in California have the film Sideways to thank, at least in part, for the popularity of this pastime that this is such an important piece of what keeps us going.
Right. No, you did answer my question. That was excellent insight. I that makes complete sense. It might be an unfair comparison. It might be comparing the Swedish healthcare system to the U.S. It's, very almost worlds apart. It doesn't make any sense, because the French agritourism is basically anywhere you go in France. They have a completely different approach to food, and the French paradox is given a name for a reason, right? Of when you source excellent food, all well produced or mostly well produced, and within regional proximity of place, the whole experience is immersive wherever you go. But to your credit, to evolve your approach to make it domestic U.S., to appeal to a consumer base that's looking for something different, that takes time and being nimble in the approach of offering. So Jason, for my last question, I wanted to ask you a bit about, depending on who you listen to, food and drink can be equally good and bad for your health. And wine has seemed to transcend many of those discussions, where it seems to be a consensus that most people believe that especially red wine is good for you. A glass a day is very good for you. It helps the heart and lowers blood pressure, many positive attributes to it. But I always get a little wound up in that, especially maybe it comes from my lens of the food side. In the same discussion about certain food categories being good or bad, they never talk about the sourcing practices, which seems to be the real silver bullet in all of this. So if you have wine that's has filled with persistent pesticides and fungicides and herbicides and amendments used, synthetic chemicals used in the production model, you can pretty much guarantee that's not going to be healthy for you. So what have you done as one of the leading forces here in domestic progressive approach to differentiated agriculture and in your wine growing, to help people understand that yes, it is a category that's better for you. It's not a bad thing. It's good. It's an experience, and it's not a huge hit on your health. And in fact, your wine, following a rule of biodynamics, is one of those wines that's quite good for you. So have you found a way to differentiate within your industry so you can continue to educate your consumer that these values matter?
I would say that has not particularly been a focus. I don't think there's well, I'm not sure if that's the right way to put it. I have always been reluctant to point to what I consider bad practices within the world of wine, partly because I don't feel like talking about other people in your industry or in your community in a negative way, paints you in a great light. But equally because I think wine in general has some real benefits over almost any other form of alcohol, in that it's based on fruit, which is generally good for you. I mean, there's a huge amount of antioxidants and other positive things in the skins of wine grapes, partly because even in its more industrial applications, wine grapes are relatively low intervention. They don't require a lot in the way of pesticides or herbicides or other things compared to most row crops or other perennial orchards. So they're generally pretty environmentally friendly. They're pretty low water use. And the net result is that like any wine is probably a pretty good beverage, both in terms of environmental impact and in terms of health impact compared to, say, liquor or beer, which is generally going to be made from less healthy starting materials and in a more industrial way. Again, I only sort of answered your question, but...
That's good. You're expressing to me that intrinsically the nature of the beast is a better process. So no matter what wine you're getting, it's going to be better than most. So that it probably has a deserved reputation of being for you because of being better for you because of those reasons.
And the other thing that I would add to that is that I don't think that, and I know I can certainly point to a couple of counterexamples, but I don't think in general people are drinking wine because it's good for you. I think people are drinking wine because it is delicious and evocative of a place, and it's a great accompaniment to a lot of meals. And I don't want to turn it into something that feels clinical or medicinal. I'm certainly very happy to talk about the ways in which we farm that I think do have really good impacts, not just on the flavors of the grapes that we grow and therefore the wines that we make, but also in terms of our environment and our community and our team that works the vineyards and in the cellar. But I think that fundamentally it's about how it tastes. And for me, that's what it all comes back to, that the it's great to have all of the kind of positive side effects of the way that we farm. But fundamentally, it's about making the best possible wines that we can make that taste the most clearly of the place that they come from. And if that comes through, then kind of the rest is just gravy.
Sure. Yeah, that first glass of wine, it's taste and experience. But maybe it is that second. Maybe it's justification for that second glass to say, well, it's good for me too, right?
The third, absolutely.
The third for the third glass, it's my glass is empty, so I need a third glass, right? So it's a process. So Jason, if you could share with the audience a bit more where they could learn about Tablas Creek, and could you share where you host your informational blog and intriguing blog that you host?
So easiest way for people to find out more is probably starting online. Our website is tablascreek.com. So that's TABLASCREEK.com. There's a link off of that to the blog that we do, and I use that to, again, try to continue the process of getting people inside what we do and what we're thinking about and worrying about. That's linked off of the website. And then, of course, we love people to come and visit. We're in the hills west of Paso Robles. It's a nice community of 315 maybe wineries now in the country, on the coast of California. So those are the main ways that people will come to find us is on our website, on our blog, come to see us, or on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram at Tablas Creek in all cases.
That's great. Well, I opened our conversation by saying that you're a modern winery, which is a mislabel, definitely. I would say that by listening to your expression and what you've defined for us, you might be a cutting-edge, authentic approach. And as you said, you help people fall in love through experiences, which I thought was very nicely put on what wine really does represent to us and the values associated to. So, Jason Haas, I can't thank you enough for partaking in today's conversation. I learned a great deal. This was very informative for me. I come now brief with much more information about wineries and what's going on in the U.S. and domestic markets. So I thank you for partaking in today's conversation.
That's my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
All right. Thanks, Jason. Take care.
Thanks, Aaron. You too.
Bye-bye.